Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is episode 106 on herpetology with Professor Susan Evans of University College London. So firstly, apologies for not sticking to our usual release schedule. I got called out to work on the rigs at the end of November, and then I spent most of December actually working, and then flew over the festive period and a couple of interviews that didn't really work out. But we're back. We're back on course, and 2020 should be an excellent year for PaleoCast. And kicking us off this year is the latest member of our team, so I'd like to introduce you all to Elsa.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Welcome to the team. So, can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, of course. I'm delighted to be joining PaleoCast, helping to bring our listeners some regular doses of extinct goodness. So my name is Elsa Pancharoli. I'm a postdoctoral researcher. I'm fresh out of my PhD at the National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh. And I'm now part of Roger Benson's lab at the University of Oxford.
Cool. And what are you studying?
Well, my main interests are biomechanics, systematics and ecology of mammals, the earliest mammals and their predecessors, so cynodonts, particularly in the Jurassic. I do a lot of work with micro-CT and synchrotron data, so reconstructing fossil skeletons, but also using those data to look at histology and developmental biology.
Cool. So we've recently had a lot of requests for mammal episodes. Is that something that you'd be right up your street then? Or are you looking to branch out and do interviews about pretty much anything?
A bit of both. I mean, I am definitely biased. I love mammals and I definitely want to bring you some superb mammal content. But I'd say my interests are they're eclectic. So I'm curious about pretty much everything. And maybe in upcoming episodes of PaleoCast, I could share that curiosity with our equally curious listeners.
Awesome. And have you done much outreach work before?
Yeah, I do. I do quite a lot of outreach. Lots of public talks, so with adults, but also with kids. I do things like Scottish fossil workshops. But I also am a freelance writer, so I've written in the past for The Guardian, and I also write for sort of other magazines and online and print publications.
Awesome. And do you have any social media tags for if any of our audience want to follow you in your research?
Yeah, I absolutely do. You can find me at G Science Lady. So that's the letter G, Science Lady.
Awesome. And so can you tell us about this, your first interview? Who's it with? Why did you choose to do this?
Yeah, well, in these interviews, I'd really like to look for contributions from a real diverse range of talented researchers. And I'd like to find people who are extremely experienced, but maybe also people who are really early career. So in this episode, I'm going to speak to Professor Susan Evans, and I'm really excited about this because she's someone who's a leader in her field and a great scientist and who I really admire for her work. So yeah, I really enjoyed recording this and I hope our listeners enjoy listening. I'm Elsa Pancharoli and welcome to PaleoCast. Have you ever looked into a garden pond and caught sight of a newt? Well, they're a type of lesser amphibian and that's the group that includes frogs and Sicilians. Newts belong to a branch we call salamanders and they may look a bit like soggy lizards, but they are of course something quite distinct and far removed from reptiles. But what exactly are salamanders and what did they evolve from? Well, the evolutionary origins of salamanders are one of the biggest mysteries still to be solved by paleontologists. And one of the leading scientists trying to answer this question is paleontologist and herpetologist, Professor Susan Evans from the University College London. Now, Susan is one of the world's leading experts on amphibians and reptiles. She's authored over 150 papers on the subject, is a fellow of the Linnaean Society and a scientific fellow of the Zoological Society. And her work takes her around the world in an effort to understand the evolution of reptiles and amphibians. I'm delighted to be visiting Susan at her lab here at UCL, so she can tell us more about these elusive groups. Welcome to PaleoCast, Susan.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start by asking you about your origins. So how did you become to be a paleontologist You know, was it something that you always knew you wanted to do?
No, I wanted to be David Attenborough.
Don't we all?
When I was a kid. No, I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I was at school. Played with medicine, veterinary. As I say, I really wanted to go study animals. So I did a degree in zoology. First year, still had no idea what I wanted to do. Wasn't overly interested in fossils. Preferred sort of small furry things. And then in the summer of my first year, I read a book by Raymond Dart about his finding of the first, what we now call Australopithecines in South Africa. And I found that very interesting. And then in the first term of my second year, a friend of mine dragged me, really, because I wanted to go fencing, but she dragged me to a seminar that was given by Richard Leakey, who, of course, is the paleoanthropologist who works in Kenya. His father did a lot of work on the Olduvai Gorge. And he had come to the UK having found what we now call the 1470 skull, early hominid, and he'd come for a conference, but he knew the people in the geology department at Bedford College, which is where I was, and he gave this seminar, and I was just so excited. I went out of the room absolutely hopping with excitement, because I'd never thought of doing research before, and this idea that you could sort of solve the mysteries of the past and this kind of detective work, and it just thrilled me. So I tried to get into hominids, and I ended up working on reptiles and amphibians.
Yeah, that's a very sort of circuitous route to what you do. Yeah. So there's no specific reason why you've chosen herps. It's just what you've ended up in.
Well, yeah, I didn't really choose herps. Herps chose me. So I was looking for a PhD. I happened to meet Kenneth Kermack, who was here at UCL. Well, not happened. Some people put me in contact with him. He worked on early mammals, and I kind of thought, well, you know, early mammals, I can work my way up to hominids from early mammals. And basically he said, well, I've got an interesting little rhynchocephalian from one of my mammal localities. That would be a good project for you. So I smiled and said, yes, that's great. Went home and looked up what a rhynchocephalian was because I didn't know. Found it was what Sphenodon belonged to, and I knew a bit about Sphenodon, so, well, it seemed like a reasonable place to start. And then once I got going working on that material, you know, once you get going on any project, you find all the questions that there are that need answering, and you just get into it. Years later, when I had the opportunity to swap into hominids, I was so fixated on small reptiles that I just wasn't interested
anymore. Yeah. Well, I'm really delighted to have you on PaleoCast. And it's not just because your subject's really fascinating, but also because you're kind of a rarity at the moment, a professor who's female, who's like at the top of your field. And then, of course, at the moment, there's a lot of talk and a lot of drive to address the sort of diversity issues that we have in science. And I wonder, as a female scientist, what experiences you've had getting to where you are today, or maybe advice that you might have for others?
That's not one I think I can answer simply. As far as paleo is concerned, I've never felt that being a female was a big problem. When I was a postgraduate student, there were, okay, not that many women in the UK, but we used to have women paleontologists coming from other countries to the UK meetings, particularly from Poland. So at the time, there was Sofia Kilian-Jaworowska, Magdalena Bosa-Bialanika, Haska Osmolska, very powerful women scientists who basically were the leads in their institution, and they would come to the UK to the meetings, and I think they were great kind of role models in a sense. So as I say, I've never felt in the paleo community that being a woman was a problem. I guess it's more of a problem in the university system because A, there are far fewer women, in senior positions. And there has been, perhaps it's changing a little bit, a tendency to sort of push women towards the sort of tutorial roles, the more teaching roles, these kinds of things. And perhaps, certainly when I first joined the department, not a great deal of support as far as encouraging women to do research, more a tendency, as I say, to try and get you to be faculty tutor or to take on those kind of softer roles, whereas it seemed to me that there were men who were being given extra help and sort of pushed forward. Now, that's not universal. I know that there were other women who were doing better. I hope that's changing a bit. But as we know from the various surveys that are done, I think it's still... It's still difficult, I think, for women to get to the more senior positions.
Yeah.
It's, you know, one of the major problems is the break between doing at least getting onto a postdoc and then getting from a postdoc into a full-time position. Mm. And that's one of the really big drops, because in order to do that, you have to impress interview panels. And interview panels tend to be looking for mirror images of themselves to some extent. So they go for the brasher, the more self-confident kind of people who can present themselves very confidently. Women, I think, still are not so good at doing that. And so they may find it more difficult to actually get themselves into those starting positions.
Yeah, I'm being in that level at the moment myself. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, and I certainly, when I was in that position trying to get, I went to interview after interview after interview, and just didn't do very well at the interview because I wasn't good at blagging and sort of, you know, pretending I was something I wasn't. Whereas some guys, it has to admit, I think, you know, do tend to do that to some extent.
Yeah, I hope you're right that I think it is changing. Yeah, slowly. So, Susan, I introduced you as a paleontologist and a herpetologist, but can you explain to me what is herpetology? What does that mean?
Herpetology is the study of reptiles and amphibians in the sort of, I guess, the more general field, the way that the general public might understand it. So, for example, phylogenetic science, scientifically, we would regard birds as being reptiles, but generally a herpetologist would not be understood as you know, looking at birds. So it's kind of non-bird reptiles,
right,
and amphibians, essentially.
Okay. There are a sort of around about 16,000 species of different kinds of herp, is that right? Which is huge.
Something like that. I haven't added it up, but yeah, there's about 10,000 squamates, there's a few dozen crocs, there's a few hundred turtles, I'm not quite sure what the number of turtles is, and there are lots and lots of frogs and not as many salamanders and a lot fewer Sicilians.
Ah, that is interesting. So, but in general, there's a lot of these groups.
Yeah,
so
they're very successful.
They must play a really key role in ecosystems.
At the lower levels of the ecosystems, yes, I would guess. I mean, in most cases, these are very small animals, so they can occupy lots of different niches. Obviously, they're taking insects. They're a food source for a lot of larger things. I guess in the Mesozoic, at least, they would have been a food source for dinosaurs and larger mammals and various things. Whenever you see an image of small dinosaur running through the sort of Cretaceous of China, it's usually got a lizard in its hand or a lizard in its jaws or something like that.
Yeah. Am I right that you've had a whole clade of squamates named after you? Evanosauria.
Yes, but I'm not sure it's still valid.
Okay.
I think I've probably been consigned to the sort of, you know, defunct group.
Well, the other one I read was that you have an Eocene agamid lizard, Vastinagama susani.
I do, and I have, there's a mammal, and there's a rhynchocephalian, and there's one or two other, I think there's a one or two more lizard. I think I'm up to about seven.
That must be pretty cool.
Quite a diversity of things.
It must be pretty, like, I feel quite an honour to have stuff like that.
Kind of, I guess, but, you know, we all name things after.
Well, I think the honours are very well deserved. Obviously, you pioneered using cladistics to understand reptiles and amphibians, so it makes sense that people do that. And you've also worked on some really amazing specimens. So one that really stands out is a giant frog from the late Cretaceous of Madagascar, Beelzebufo ampinga. Can you tell us more about that?
Right, yes. I mean, it has to be said that my colleagues in America kind of went for the largest size estimate and sort of pushed it.
Okay.
So I rather came out as being a bit bigger than it probably might have done, at least in some of the press articles.
Yeah, I read online that it could have eaten a baby dinosaur.
Well, I mean, that's probably a really baby, you know, a hatchling of a small dinosaur. It kind of, and certainly the National Geographic magazine image of it was it stuffing its face full of sort of small dinosaurs. I mean, large, it's probably the size of a large Pyxicephalus, which is the African bullfrog, or a large caratophrine frog. So, yeah, it was a sort of getting close to some of the big frogs, biggest frog that we...
In like terms of a pet, so like a guinea pig size?
Yeah, a guinea pig.
Okay.
Yeah, right. something like a guinea pig, yes, yeah. But with a... mostly mouth, with a really big mouth, and, you know, a short, squat body and probably rather short, squat legs. So caratophrine frogs have basically been described as sort of a mouth on legs. And so Beelzebufo was probably something like, you know, was sort of, that's a mouth on legs, and would probably have eaten anything that sort of walked past it.
Yeah, it's a great name.
The name came because when they started to find bits of it, the field workers at the time in Madagascar were picking these kind of bits up, and they kind of christened it the sort of devil frog or the, you know, Beelzebub frog. And so when we came to think of a name for it, the logical thing to go for, we know we play with it, is do we dare sort of thing. Yeah, why not? Let's call it Beelzebufo after Beelzebub. It's kind of...
I think it's great. Very memorable, which is...
It's very memorable. Yeah. If you look at, if you put it up on Wikipedia or you know, the various search engines, look at images, there are lots and lots of cartoons of a frog with sort of, you know, devil's tail and horns.
Now, it was, of course, a frog, so that's a type of lysamphibian. But one thing that I've always been puzzled about is the difference between using the word amphibian or lysamphibian. Why would you use one and not the other? What does it mean?
Well, lysamphibian, lys means smooth. So it means, literally, it means an amphibian with smooth skin. Now, of course, Sicilians, we now know, can have sort of little scales underneath under the skin. But the lysamphibia are the group that contain the modern amphibians. So, you know, frogs, salamanders, Sicilians. Amphibian, in the sort of very general word, is kind of, they're kind of the tetrapods, at least in the older usage, were the tetrapods that sort of weren't either reptiles or mammals. What we would now call paraphyletic group, because there are different groups. Now we recognise, with phylogenetic analysis, we recognise that there are different groups within that. The lysamphibians are probably a proper group, in other words, more related to one another than there are to anything else, but that's one of the controversial issues at the moment. So there are lots of lineages of ancient amphibians, some of which had scales, little bony plates in their skin even, and so they probably had tougher skin than modern lysamphibians, where you've got this smooth, wet skin and they do a lot of gas exchange, for example, through the skin at various times of the year. So, yeah, lysamphibia is as I say, the modern group. Amphibians generally are tetrapods that are not reptiles or mammals, but cladistically they are tetrapods that are closer to lis amphibians than to any group of sort of amniotes.
Yeah.
And then there's all the stuff in the at the bottom of the tree that people call tetrapodomorphs, or, you know, different names for it that are not perhaps strictly amphibians, but they're sort of tetrapods that are not quite amphibians and not quite amniotes.
A bit murky.
Murky, yes.
Yeah. It seems like China's really transformed our knowledge of lots of different groups. I mean, I know working on mammals, it certainly has. Is the same true for herps?
It's certainly true for amphibians, or at least for salamanders. Before the material started to come out of China, probably what we knew of early salamanders could basically have been fitted in a shoebox. So there were fragmentary remains from a few places in North America, in Europe. One or two specimens from Central Asia, a series of specimens that we pulled out of Las Hoyas in Spain, which is another limestone locality in Spain. So that was some nice material. But even so, you know, up to about 10 specimens rather than sort of dozens.
Right.
The Chinese material, there are hundreds and hundreds of specimens. The deposits of the G-hole biota are rich, really, really rich in amphibians. I mean, you basically dig a little hole in the back of somebody's, you know, garden and pull out bits of amphibian. And the preservation is exquisite. So you can see the soft tissues, you can see the, you know, the external gills, you can see sort of the gut contents.
Wow.
Not bad for lizards, but I mean, it's not as good for lizards. So there are lots of specimens of one particular lizard called Eubenosaurus that we've worked on. We now know an awful lot about Eubenosaurus. We know what it ate. We know that it gave live birth because we found specimens with babies inside. We now know its coloration. We've just got a paper come out that shows it was striped.
That's so cool.
But there's less diversity and we know less about some of the rarer taxa. I'm sure that'll change, and it's beginning to change, but it's salamander heaven.
Well, I mean, I saw this amazing larval cryptobranchoid salamander from China, but and it had a flattened tail and the gills were preserved, and it even had a belly full of concostricans. So it was really spectacular. But then I started thinking, like, obviously, they have a really interesting life cycle, amphibians. So how do you, in the fossil record, make sense of that you might find a fossil that was perhaps not actually a fully grown adult, because they go through this metamorphosis, don't they? How do you piece that sort of thing together? Well, maybe first, could you tell us a little bit about that life cycle and then how you make sense of it in the fossil record?
Well, I mean, one of the things that characterises modern lis amphibians is, of course, they go through this metamorphosis. So the eggs are generally laid in water or in a wet environment. They generally hatch out into tadpoles, little water-living tadpoles that have external gills. Then those mature, and typically then they would lose the external gills, and then they would turn into a land-living adult that was breathing with lungs. Various groups have got around that. So some frogs, for example, get around the tadpole stage, which is obviously a vulnerable stage, by mouth brooding, holding the eggs in their mouths, burying them in their backs, carrying them around, doing all sorts of strange things, putting them in little pools up in trees to get around this idea. Salamanders, there's less of that sort of diversity of behaviour, but what a number of salamander groups do is simply not go through metamorphosis. So they remain as in the juvenilized form with external gills, but become sexually mature in that form. And so you get something that looks like a larval form, but is sexually mature and is able to breed. Sometimes they can switch between the different morphs. So, you know, you might have one that is usually seen with external gills, but if you pop it into a different environment, perhaps that's got a different, you know, it's got more iodine in the water or something like this, then they will grow up and they'll metamorphose into an ordinary, kind of ordinary salamander.
That's incredibly flexible.
There is a flexibility in it, but then that's cool. Of course, there's an advantage to that because it means that they can occupy aquatic environments, but they can also potentially, at least in some cases, but not all cases, metamorphose and go on to land if the environment is not right. But you're right, it causes huge problems in terms of working the phylogeny of these things, because a number of different groups have evolved that strategy of what we call pedomorphosis, in other words, being able to be sexually mature in a juvenilized body form. And there's lots of different groups that have done it independently. And so if you try and run a morphological analysis where you try and use morphological characters, anatomical characters, in order to work out relationships, then there's a real danger that all of your pedomorphic forms are going to fall together.
Yeah.
And as you say, you've also got the problem if you find one fossil that's clearly of a pedomorphic form, what you don't know necessarily is whether this is a sexually mature form of one or whether you've got a baby that's going to grow up and go into something else. So you've got to try and use modern taxa, modern animals, to see if you can work out from the degree of skeletal development whether it's likely to be mature or not. But even then, if it's pedomorphic, if it's juvenilized, then the chances are its skeleton isn't as well ossified anyway, even as an adult. And so it does cause a lot of problems.
Well, that seems like a really good point for me to make a confession to our listeners that this is actually not the first time that I've met Susan. I'm actually currently a very small cog in a fantastic project that Susan's heading up with colleagues, which is actually trying to understand the origins of salamanders. Now, my role is very small. I segment CT scans of living salamanders in order to make a database for experts like Susan to use. So, Susan, I've been sitting for weeks now segmenting scans and making models of extant salamander bones for you and for your colleagues. Why am I doing this? Can you tell me about your salamander project and how that database that I'm helping make is going to be used?
Okay, so two different bits of this. First of all, what the general project is. So one of the problems that we have in understanding the origins of all modern Lys amphibians is that there is a big temporal gap, there's a big time gap separating the first fossil records of frogs, salamanders and Sicilians from the groups from which they may have originated. That has been for a long time and is continuing to cause all kinds of problems and discussions and controversies as to which group of those ancient amphibians our modern salamanders may have come from, and indeed whether they all came from the same groups of fossil amphibians or whether they came from several different groups, and there are different opinions as to whether that is. So one of the key things that we need to do, and it's exactly the same with lizards and with a number of other groups, is to try and fill that temporal gap and try and find the intermediates. So the earliest examples of salamanders, Sicilians, frogs, lizards, in order to try and better understand what characters they've got so that we can try and track back and recognise what the ancestors are likely to be. There's a big problem with frogs, but at least we have one or two very early frogs. With salamanders, the first really good material of salamanders that you get, well, at least until some of the Chinese material came, were from sort of the latter part of the Jurassic period. So 140 million years, that sort of time. Some of those looked very primitive, but there's one specimen from Central Asia, some rather fragmentary material from Russia. Now we have all this Chinese material, but the interesting thing is that the Chinese material, for the most part, seem to belong either to modern groups or to ones that seem to be quite close to modern groups. So they look rather like modern salamanders in their skeletal anatomy. They don't look particularly primitive. So even though some of them are quite old, they don't help us link salamanders to anything in the past. What we want to try and find are some of the more primitive salamanders so that we can see what characteristics they may have that will help us to track back and identify the groups from which they come. Now, many years ago, we started to work with material in from Oxfordshire, and there are one or two quarries both in Oxfordshire and also in other parts of sort of central UK that yield the remains of Middle Jurassic, 165, 166 million year old, fragmentary material of lizards, of frogs, of some salamanders, and various other things that were important because they filled a gap already that there was very little material known. As far as the salamanders from that period, we could recognise that there were several different types of salamander, and we could fit some bones and sort of say, well, we think these belong to this taxon and these ones probably belong to something else, but never enough to really get a good idea as to how what they might have looked like. Never enough pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, if you like, to actually visualise what this animal might have been like and therefore try and fit it into a phylogeny. You know, the great thing now is that, you know, there's this locality on the Isle of Skye. We did some work there some years ago. An earlier group, partly from Bristol, Michael Waldman, who was a teacher at Stowe School, had done some work there and had found some fossil remains there, some of which were associated specimens of things that we were finding in Oxfordshire. Subsequent work more recently there, particularly by Roger in Oxford, Roger Benson, and the group he's been leading, now is finding a lot more really great associated material. And so what our project is from the fossil side to CT scan that material to segment it out again. My postdoc, Mark Jones, is also spending weeks, months sitting there segmenting out fossil material. And there's some really great material, and we're going to get some really beginning to understand what these things look like. We're going to be able to actually print out, copies of the bones and put the bones together and get a much clearer idea of what some of these things are like. And some of them seem to be really primitive. And so I'm really, really excited about what we're finding. So that's one aspect of it. The other problem that we have in terms of making morphological trees, in other words, basing trees on morphological characters, is that really we have not a great deal of understanding of the variation in shape of different bones within salamanders. So, for example, if I compare it with lizards, there's been a lot of work done on skulls in lizards. There's been a reasonable amount of work done on the postcranial skeleton of lizards. So we have a reasonable idea of how particular bones in lizards vary depending on which group they belong to. We know a lot less about how different bones in different amphibian groups vary and whether or not there are characteristic shapes for different families of salamanders, for example. So that if you find salamander bones in a fossil locality, there is really very little to compare it with to think about well, does this particular vertebrate, does it tell me anything about which group of modern salamanders it could belong to? Or does it tell me anything about how vertebrae might have evolved and differentiated in modern salamanders? Because we don't have a good handle on the degree of variation that you get in vertebral morphology, in scapulocoracoid morphology, in pelvic morphology, in humerus morphology. And so for that reason, if you look at data matrices where people have listed characters that they're going to use for trying to assess which group a particular amphibian might belong to, the characters are not very good. And so you see things being clumped together within, for example, cryptobranchid, which is the sort of large amphibians that you get in China and Japan, for example, like the giant salamander. People grouping things with those on the basis just of one or two characters that are almost certainly convergent. And so the reason that we wanted, alongside working on the fossil material, to make a really comprehensive atlas of modern skeletal material in salamanders was to provide a resource that we can use to try and identify new characters that we can use in developing a phylogeny, but also to provide, to produce an online resource where somebody who's found perhaps some salamander remains in a fossil locality can flip through and look at a series of images and say, ah, I can see, yes, mine looks rather like that. And so that may be what my sort of particular bone belongs to. Well, yes, I've got a frontal bone from the skull and I've got a jaw and I've got that. And this, they all fit into perhaps it belongs to that family. So it's a mixture of trying to provide a resource that people can use to try and identify their material, but also to try and get a handle on the variation and whether there is any significant variation that we can use in order to try and understand which group things might belong to. But also from the other perspective that we were talking about previously, which is trying to understand how bone shape changes through development, so that perhaps we are better able to recognize whether that's a juvenile bone and how much a particular bone shape might change between the aquatic form that's got a scapula, that's got its shoulder girdle, and how that shoulder girdle might change if it becomes metamorphosed, if it becomes, you know, a fully adult form. To try and understand the variation. So that's why you're sitting there trying to, you know, prepare all of those. Because I think, you know, what I would like to see is, you know, 50 or 60 scapular shoulder girdles so that we can see whether there's variation. But also to look at the shoulder girdle perhaps in, you know, 20 or 30 of the same genus to see how much variation there is within a particular species or across a particular range. Because again, you know, we look at a bone and say, well, it's different from that one. But unless you know the range of individual variation, you can't, it's very difficult to say, well, that's a new species because it's got that extra knob on it that one hasn't got. But perhaps that's just normal variation within a particular group.
I've certainly been quite struck with how I think they're not actual variation. It's not variation I'm seeing, but weird mutations where a vertebrae, half of the vertebrae will be kind of a weirdly fused and things like that. And I keep thinking, how does this animal survive? They seem to be able to survive with quite a lot of very strange things gone wrong with their skeleton. Is that a fair thing to say? I mean, in mammals, I don't think we see it so often.
That's an interesting observation that obviously is something we should kind of think about. You know, as we're going along. But as far as vertebral morphology is concerned, what certainly the work that's been done on mammals suggests that they are far more constrained in what they do as far as their vertebrae are concerned than other groups. So, for example, you know, mammals are much more constrained as to vertebral numbers. So virtually every mammal has the same number of neck vertebrae, whereas in reptiles and birds, you can have any number of neck vertebrae. There isn't the same constraint operating. Why this is, there's a lot of speculation as to why it is. So, but maybe the more so-called advanced you get, the less flexibility there is as far as, you know, what you can do with your body and still manage to survive. Who knows? That's just speculation.
You mentioned earlier that there were competing theories about where salamanders actually sit in the group. So could you maybe summarise what those different theories are and, you know, where do we currently stand on their origins? What's the favourite theory?
I'm not sure there's a favourite theory. It depends on who you speak to. If you do molecular analyses, then Sicilian salamanders and frogs come out as more closely related to one another than any of them do to, for example, the amniotes, and the amniotes of the group, reptiles, birds, mammals. Whereas there are some theories out there that Sicilians particularly might be more closely related to a group of amphibians that are on the stem of amniotes. So if we look back at the sort of ancient amphibians, just to call them that for the moment without using too much of a technical term, among them there is a kind of broad division into a group that are called the lepisbondyls. The name is not that important, but generally now there's a feeling that that group may lie closer to the stem of the amniotes, which are the reptiles, the birds, the mammals. Whereas there is another group, which is called the temnospondyls, and many people, but not everyone, thinks that those amongst those are the ancestors of the modern list amphibians. That, if you like, is the kind of standard view, and that all of the modern amphibians are more closely related to one another than they are to any other ancient group, and that they all derived from that temnospondyl lineage. However, there are other people who argue either that all of list amphibians actually come from the lepisbondyl group and therefore are more closely related to the stem of amniotes, and that all these temnospondyls are just random mixed up things. And then there are others that argue that perhaps the Sicilians belong to the lepisbondyl group, whereas the frogs and the salamanders are derived from the temnospondyls, and so they are not actually that closely related to one another. Now, if that is the case, then using molecular evidence, that would predict that if you were to run an analysis with looking at amniotes, Sicilians, frogs, and salamanders, that the Sicilians should group with the amniotes in molecular analyses, whereas the other two should group together and be quite separate. Now, in fact, when you do a molecular analysis, all of the list amphibians group together. So that tends to counter the idea, although it hasn't destroyed it completely, because there are still some people who will argue for it, tends to counter the idea that the Sicilians are separate from the frogs and salamanders. But that still leaves debate as to where the list amphibians come from, or whether they come from the lepisbondyl line or whether they come from the temnospondyl line. And as I say, part of the problem there is that you've got this big temporal gap between the two. And if you run an analysis, it depends on whose data matrix you use.
This is why we loop back to
exactly.
The importance of data matrices.
The importance of data matrices. So two data matrices apparently coding exactly the same groups of animals. You run an analysis, and in one case you will get the list amphibians coming out with the lepisbondyls, and in another case when you do it, you'll get them coming out with the temnospondyls. So there's something happening in the way that they're coding, or the way that the characters are being interpreted, that is creating that issue. what one hopes is that perhaps if we can fill in more of the details of the intermediates, then that might just help to sort out some of that. Because of the long temporal gap, you can have odd things happening. So perhaps if we get a better understanding of what really primitive salamanders look like, or whether indeed these things that we're getting from Sky are primitive salamanders, or whether they're primitive lizamphibians of some sort, because sometimes when you run the matrix, they fall out of salamanders completely and fall down onto the stem. Maybe that will help us begin to, you know, adding that extra, those extra taxa into the data matrix may perhaps help to consolidate things. Although I'm not totally hopeful that that's going to be the case.
Well, I hope so. Well, we've talked lots about the salamander origins and that project. Of course, you've got lots and lots of different projects on the go. Is there anything else you're currently exploring that you would like to tell our listeners about?
We're working on lots of different things. So with colleagues in China, I'm working on other animals that come from the deposits that the Chinese specimens come from. There's a little group of aquatic reptiles called the Charistodeers, and they are particularly well represented in Eastern Asia. It seems to have been the sort of centre of activity in the early part of the Cretaceous and the Jurassic. So we're working on new material from those deposits, but also recently started to work on some material that comes from a coal mine, slightly younger material. Where we're getting lizards, we're getting Charistodeers. And so, I mean, it literally is in coal. You can't see anything virtually from the surface, but again, if you put it in a CT scanner, then you can see an awful lot more. We've just submitted a paper on a new Charistodeer from one of those coal mines. So that's certainly one area that we're working with, working also with Chinese colleagues on some lizard material from later in the Cretaceous, but also the other side, past the end Cretaceous extinction. And that's particularly interesting, I think, because a lot of our ideas about what survived the end Cretaceous extinction come from North America, where you can follow through from the late Cretaceous into the early part of the Paleocene. Whereas in other parts of the world, and particularly in Eastern Asia, there has been fantastic deposits yielding small reptiles, lizards, from the late Cretaceous. But we know very little about the Paleocene faunas from those regions. Mm. And so we can see what was there and the diversity that was there in the late Cretaceous. What we don't know is what survived it, and whether it's different from the pattern that we're seeing in North America. So most of what's been written, for example, about the fate of lizards across the Cretaceous tertiary boundary is based in North America. In Europe, we know a lot about the Paleocene, but we don't know very much about the late Cretaceous. So we really don't know too much about what survived in European localities. And as I say, in Asia, it's the other way around. We know a lot about the late Cretaceous, but we know very little about the Paleocene. And so one of the things that one of my colleagues there has been trying to do, and we've done a bit of work on it, is trying to explore more localities in the Paleocene so that we can try and understand what the lizard faunas of the Paleocene were like, so that we've got a better idea as to what was happening across that transition in Asia. So that's something else. And then, what else am I doing? All sorts of things.
That's a really interesting thing, though. With you saying that, it makes me realise that we're always talking at the end Cretaceous mass extinction, we're always talking about dinosaurs and mammals, because people do see it as if those are the only two groups that really matter across that boundary. But what did happen? What is the current understanding of what happened to herps of all different kinds?
Well, again, it varies a lot. We don't know an awful lot about small herps in general across some of these boundaries. I mean, it looks, you know, as though this amphibians, for example, almost didn't notice. And yet, you know, frogs, we get frogs going through, we get salamanders going through, we get Sicilians clearly going through. And yet all the stuff about acid rain and all of the things that, you know, are supposed to result in from this catastrophic event, you would have thought would have affected vulnerable things like small, weak-skinned lisamphibians.
Yeah.
But I think part of the problem, again, is that we don't know enough about the faunas before it, and we don't know enough about them after it in different parts of the world, really, to be able to understand what's happening. As far as lizards are concerned, we know that some groups went, the mosasaurs, the big marine reptiles, the big marine lizards, seem to have become extinct, whether at the boundary or certainly coming up to the boundary. There's also a group of large, primarily herbivorous lizards, which are known from North America and Asia, the polyglyphanodonts. They seem to have gone. Other groups, again, you know, don't really seem to have noticed. I mean, you know, there's a paper recently that plotted out individual kind of taxa and said that, you know, there had been extinction in particular lineages, and that may be the case. There's also a problem that there's a tendency, if you've got a small, not very well preserved specimen from the late Cretaceous, and then you've got something that looks a bit like it from the Paleocene, to give the one in the Paleocene a different name, whereas in fact it could be a lineage that kind of is going straight through. So I think the main, you know, we just don't know enough about faunas on both sides, and especially we don't know enough about other parts of the world other than North America, which of course was the bit that was closest to, you know, to the event. You know, what was happening in New Zealand, what was happening in Australia, a long way from the event, what was happening in Asia. It's a lot less clear.
So on Twitter, I asked people if they had any suggestions for questions that they wanted to ask you. And Ethan Kochak said he would like to ask, what is the best salamander and why is it axolotls? I think he might be a trifle biased. So I thought, Susan, let's finish up by asking you, what's your favourite herp and why?
Okay. I mean, I'll deal with the axolotls first. I give a lecture to the first year students about respiration and gas exchange. And I talk to them about, you know, the transition onto land and how, you know, gills are great, but they're only any good in water. And so I have a great picture that I show up to illustrate gills, which is an axolotl. It looks just like a Pokemon character, and everybody always goes, oh, cool. So axolotls, yeah, are cute. What's my favourite herp? Oh, it's difficult. I change my mind a lot. Mostly it's, well, there's the cute ones. Geckos, cute. I like geckos. There's just something really cute about geckos. I like Draco. Draco is the little Indonesian one with long ribs that glides. Oh. They are so cool. There's the Moloch, which is an Australian sort of spiky one that has fantastic dentition and crawls around eating ants.
What about fossils?
Fossils. What's my favourite?
Because you did a lot of work, sort of the pioneering work at Kirtlington here in England.
Yes.
The Middle Jurassic stuff. So is it one of them, or are they too fragmentary to make it into the top list?
With fossils, I would have to, I think, to step outside either lizards or modern lisamphibian groups. With the fossils, it's got to be alpenopodontids.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So these, for people who don't know, this is another group of amphibians, possibly related to Lys amphibians that almost made it through to the present day. We picked them up in Kirtlington in the Middle Jurassic, which is one of the earliest places that we find them. And then they go right through into the Pliocene period, where you find them with modern groups of lizards and salamanders. But for some reason, they disappeared. And they're one of these kind of mystery groups that we're now beginning to sort of unravel gradually. We found the first complete albinoperitontid material that was known in Las Hoyas in Spain, which we got into Nature. It's the only time I've managed to get a paper in Nature.
I suppose salamanders and herps don't catch the headlines.
They don't, unless it's something that people know about, like geckos or snakes or something like that. And that can lead to a load of rot being written. But we're currently working on some really fantastic new albinoperitontid material. And they are such... They are really cool and weird little critters. So I think they and some of the Charistidae too. That's another weird, enigmatic little group of reptiles. And again, this is a group that really very, very little was known about before I started doing work on them and realised that some of these smaller things belong to the same group. And I think now we have a much better understanding, but we still don't know what they're related to. So, yeah, on the amphibian side, I think it's albinoperitontids, and on the reptile side, probably some of these little Charistidaes that we're working on.
Well, thank you so much for agreeing to be on Paleocast. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Yes.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin-Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.